Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Torah Studies. I am your host, Rabbi Ari. I am broadcasting live from Atlanta, Georgia, but you may be wherever you are, and that is okay. That is definitely okay. Fran, I should mention, it's on the way. All right, Fran knows what I'm talking about. Good. Now, here is the deal. Tonight, we're talking about three things, and three things are going to converge. If all goes well, we'll have three things that will converge very soon. What are the three things? Number one, the story of Korach. Number two, almonds. Yes, almonds. And number three, the life and legacy of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So let me explain. This week's Torah portion is Korach. So of course, we're going to speak about Korach. Korach is the main character, the main villain of our Torah portion. So we're going to speak about Korach, number one. Number two, we're going to speak about almonds. And you'll see soon why we talk about almonds. It's not salad night here at, in Town Jewish Academy. No, it is part of the story of Korach, but we're going to be speaking about the nature of almonds. And then finally, we're going to speak about the Lubavitcher Rebbe and his life and legacy insofar as tonight, well, starting after nightfall, is the third day of Tammuz, which is the yard site of the Rebbe. And it is tonight the 26th yard site of the Lubavitcher Rebbe, who passed away in 1994. So this is now 26 years. 26, of course, is a very special number. It's the numerical value of the name Havaya Yudke Vavke, God's name. So it's a very special power, very special energy, and we have a lot of special lessons that come together in tonight's session. Okay, so let's begin. Here's what you need to know. The story of Korach, story of our portion, takes place chronologically after the story that was told in last week's Torah portion, the story of the spies. So again, let me just recap this. Last week we read about the story of the spies. 12 representatives of the nation, one per tribe, who went to scout out the land of Israel, came back with a negative or disheartening report. The land is beautiful, but giants, fortified cities, a land that consumes its inhabitants, there's no way. And at that point, the people rebelled, the people cried, the people rejected going into the land. And God said, I'm not going to force you. You don't want to go in, you're not going to go in. 40 years of wandering, your children, the next generation, they will go in. That's last week's story in a nutshell. Following that story, very shortly after that story, the story of the debacle of the spies, comes this week's Torah portion, Korach. Who was Korach? Korach was a cousin of Moshe Rabbeinu, of Moses. So we're talking about the cousin of Moshe, who decides that he is going to create a populist or lead a populist revolution. Power to the people, no more leadership, tear down the walls of leadership of Moses and Aaron, and everyone is holy. Kumbaya, my friends. Okay, so what I want to do is I'm going to share my screen. And the reason why I'm sharing my screen is in order to go through these texts together. So I feel like this was smoother the first few weeks for the simple reason that all y'all had your fingers ready to unmute yourself. Lately, I love you all, but the last few weeks, it's been a little bit slow on the go. So I'm happy to read all the texts, but if you guys want to participate in reading the text, which I think is nice, I personally enjoy it, then I need you to be ready for the unmuting. I go through random order. I guess if it's random, it's not order, but I go in a random sequence that is not based on anything in particular, just in the way it lines up by me. Again, if you want to read, then have your unmute button ready. If you don't want to read, just indicate that you don't want to, and we will move on. Okay, I want to begin with text number one. Text 1A. Because this is the opening, this is literally the opening, these are the opening verses of our Torah portion, and it discusses the origins or the rise of this attempted coup, this attempted mutiny. So Dr. Maxi, if you are ready to roll, Please unmute yourself and take it away with Korach.
Korach, the son of Izhar, the son of Kehot, the son of Levi, took himself to one side, along with Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab, and on the son of Peleth, descendants of Reuben. They confronted Moses together with 250 men from the children of Israel, chieftains of the congregation, representatives of the assembly, men of repute. They assembled against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for the entire congregation is holy, and God is in their midst. So why do you raise yourselves above God's assembly?"
Thank you. Very straightforward claim against Moses and Aaron. They said, "Who are you to be asserting yourselves as leaders over the people? Everyone is holy." In the Hebrew, kulam kedoshim, ev ki kol ha'eda kulam kedoshim, the entire congregation, they're all holy, uvetocham Hashem, and amongst them is God. So why are you lifting yourselves up? Why do you elevate yourselves in these positions of leadership over God's assembly? If you ever could frame a speech, like a rallying cry for a populist revolution, power to the people, let's tear down the hierarchy, let's get rid of the hierarchy, let's bring power back to the people, if you ever wanted to write that speech, you don't need to. You got it right here. You have it right here. That's exactly what Korach is trying to do. Tear down the leadership of Moshe and Aaron, Moses and Aaron, under the guise of everyone is holy, God is with everybody. Why do we need those who lift themselves up over God's people? Now, of course, the irony, and it's not irony, of course, the devious part of this whole story is that Korach wasn't exactly leading a revolution for the people. He was simply trying to supplant the leadership of Moshe and Aaron and take it for himself. We know this because we know this, and it's found in all the commentaries. We know that Korach had an agenda. His agenda was get rid of Moses, get rid of Aaron, and he would be installed. You know, if you're the one leading all the people, and the people get their way, well, someone still has to lead all the people. Might as well be Korach, right? That's how it always happens like that, right? It always happens. What about the French Revolution? That was peaceful, right? No one lost their lives? Super peaceful? French Revolution? Yeah. Liberté, fraternité, égalité, Sandrine, am I getting this right? I always go to you for my reference here.
Very good, thank you.
Listen, I do what I can. You know, I dabble in French Revolution stuff. So listen, here's the deal. You know, the supposed line, the supposed angle of Korach is liberty, fraternity, the other one, right? That everybody should be together, right? Everybody is on the same page and we don't need leadership. Everyone is in it together and it sounds so beautiful. It sounds so romantic. It sounds so like you want to embrace it. You know what the problem is? It wasn't true. It's not what he wanted. He wanted to have the power. But you know, I was mentioning this in our Daily Power Parsha over the last few days. You can't go and tell everybody your real intention. I mean, you can't say, "Hey, let's get rid of these guys and put me in." I mean, you could, but he felt like his angle would be, you know, a little bit stronger if he presented it that it's all for the people. That way he could get some more buy-in. Okay, so fine, but that was his agenda. Now, what happens next is that Moses tells him it's a bad idea. Cousin, this is not a good idea. This is a bad idea. It's not going to end well. We didn't put ourselves in. You know that God has chosen us to do this. It's not going to work. Spare yourself from disappointment and punishment and worse. Spare yourself, back off. I mean, he says it in a nice way. He says kind of like, you know, step away from this coup. He doesn't. He doesn't. Korach goes full steam ahead. Now Korach gathers together. As you saw over here, it was Korach along with Datan and Abiram and On ben Pelet. And in addition, there were 250 others, chieftains of the congregation. So those were essentially Korach's core group, him, a few others, and the 250 people. Throughout this conversation, it goes back and forth, this dialogue between Korach and Moshe, Korach and Moses. Look, at the end of the day, what's decided, what Moses proposes, oh, that rhymes, very interestingly enough. What Moses proposes is that there be, that they all allow God to decide who exactly is chosen. Because as I mentioned before, Korach was gunning not only for Moses' position of leadership, but also for Aaron's position of high priesthood. He wanted the big kahuna for himself. He wanted the Kohen Gadol, the kahuna gadola. He wanted the high priesthood for himself. So Moshe said to him, look, if you feel like you deserve to be a high priest, if you really feel like everyone's holy, everyone can be priests if they just wish, okay, then let's have a contest. Here's what's going to happen. Take a look. You know what? Let's read this inside. Dr. Maxi, please read text 1b as well. Here it's Moses says to Korach. Here we go.
Moshe said to Korach, you and your entire congregation should be before God, you, they, and Aaron tomorrow. Let each man take his censer and place incense upon it, and let each man present his censer before God. There will thus be 250 censers, and let you and Aaron each take his censer. So each man took his censer, and they put fire upon it and placed incense upon it, and they stood at the entrance to the tent of meeting with Moshe and Aaron. A fire came forth from God and consumed the 250 men who had offered up the incense.
All right, well that's the end of the story. So what Moshe says to Korach after he can't convince him to back off. He says, "Look, you're going to push, let God decide. So, I have a great idea. Why don't you and your group, 250 people and you, come along with censers. Censers we discovered recently, not recently, but I discovered recently, it's a copper thing that has fire and incense in it, then you can like waft it around, whatever. He says, look, take your 250 people, take 250 censers, go place incense, you also do it, Aaron will also do it, and then look, whoever God wants to do the ketorah, to do the incense, God will take, and whoever is not worthy of bringing that offering, in other words, whoever God does not choose, will face some consequences for offering an unwarranted offering. And so it happens, exactly so, it transpires, the 250 people, they bring their censers, they bring their ketoret, they bring their incense, Aaron brings his, and you saw the end of the story here, the fire came from God and consumed the 250 men who had offered up the incense. If you're thinking this sounds a bit reminiscent, it does. There were two other people who lost their lives in a very similar situation, bringing an offering that they were not supposed to bring. Who were they? Extra bonus points. Extra Torah studies bonus points.
Aaron's sons,
exactly. Nadav and Abihu, on the day of the dedication, the opening of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle for service, the day that it opened, they brought their own offering. Some say they brought exactly this. They brought the incense. Or a form of incense that they were not required, not asked, not allowed to bring. And the bottom line is that they lost their lives. They too were consumed. Korach didn't learn the lesson. He tried. They rolled a dice. 250 people brought this incense. They lost their lives. Okay, the story doesn't end. Now, you would think that this would be a good demonstration. This would show everybody, including the other, you know, the rest of the Jewish people that were observing this attempted coup, you would think that this would put an end to any attempts, that this would put an end to any questions about the authority, the leadership, or the divine appointment of Moses and Aaron. You would think that at this point, look, the fire comes forth, consumes the 250 men. Oh, I forgot to mention, the earth opens up, swallows Korach and Dathan and Aviram, so swallows them alive. These guys die by fire with the incense. Those guys die by the earth opening up. You would think at that point, case closed, right? You would think, point made. God wants Moses, God wants Aaron, and God is not interested in any other sorts of ideas. You would think that it's clear. Not so fast. There was yet another demonstration to the leadership and the authority of Moses and Aaron. Take a look at what happens next. This is, just so we're clear, this is again from the book of Numbers, chapter 17, verses 16 through 23. I just to be very, very clear, after the earth, oh, hold on, I hear noise. After, let's make sure everyone is, okay. After the earth opens up and swallows Korach, and after, and a few others, and after the 250 people die from the incense, after all of that happens, there's yet another demonstration of whom God chooses. Take a look at text 1C. You know what, Dr. Maxey, you're on a roll. Take it away, one more, let's do it.
God spoke to Moshe saying, speak to the children of Israel and take from them a staff for each father's house from all the chieftains according to their father's houses, a total of 12 staffs, and inscribe each man's name on his staff. Inscribe Aaron's name on the staff of Levi, for there is only one staff for the head of their father's house. You shall place the staffs in the tent of meeting before the Ark of the Testimony where I commune with you. The staff of the man whom I will choose will blossom, and I will calm down, turn away from myself the complaints of the children of Israel, which they are complaining against you. Moses spoke to the children of Israel, and all the chieftains gave him a staff for each chieftain according to their father's houses, a total of 12 staffs, and Aaron's staff was amidst their staffs. Moshe placed the staffs before God in the tent of the testimony. And on the following day, Moses came to the tent of testimony, and behold, Aaron's staff for the house of Levi had blossomed. It gave forth blossoms, sprouted buds, and produced ripe almonds.
Perfect, thank you. So what we have here is the second sign that divinely affirms Aaron's appointment as the high priest. Korach had a beef with Moshe and Aaron. Korach said, who put them in charge? Everyone's in charge. I want to be in charge. That's what Korach said. God said, I want to demonstrate that I have chosen Moshe and that I've chosen Aaron. So, the earth is going to swallow you. The fire is going to consume the 250 wannabe high priests who are trying to offer the incense. They're going to be consumed and die. And an additional, that's all one sign. The second sign is going to be the story of the 12 staffs. So each tribe will inscribe their tribal leader on a stick, on a staff. They'll place it in the Mishkan in the tabernacle, and they'll leave it there overnight. And by the next morning, now remember, one second. You take a staff, you take a branch from a tree, you cut it off, right? It's not going to blossom anymore, right? It's cut off from its source. You have a tree, a branch that's still plugged into the tree, still connected to its roots, still alive, that can blossom. As many of you know, I have a peach tree in front of my house. We had like hundreds of peaches this May, last a month or two ago. And some of you came over to the house and collected some peaches. And that was, it was wonderful. Good times and great oldies. Here's the deal on that. a branch will blossom, bud, and grow fruit if it's still connected. But crack off a branch, cut off a branch, that's not blossoming anymore. So the 12 tribes, each one gave a staff, a stick, inscribed their name on it so you know whose is whose, right? Right, you got to write your name on it. It's like a card thing where you sign the card, put it back in the deck, right? So each one inscribed their name on one of the staffs, put it in the tabernacle overnight. The next morning, what happened was it was only Aaron's staff from the house of Levi that blossomed. It gave forth blossoms, sprouted buds, and produced ripe almonds. Okay, so that is what happened. So here's the deal. Here's the deal. We have a few questions, and I'll tell you what those few questions are in a moment. But first, let me make sure that my camera angle is still kosher. Okay, it's for the YouTube. So, a few questions. Question number one, why the need for the second sign? Wasn't the first sign, divine sign, wasn't that first sign sufficient? Wasn't it enough of a proof that Moshe and Aaron were really chosen by God? I mean, look, Korach and his folks get swallowed up by the earth. The 250 people bringing incense are zapped. I mean, is it not obvious that God is not interested in other people trying to take over these positions, that Aaron was truly chosen? Isn't that clear from that part of the story? Why do we need the second sign, which is, again, the story of the 12 staffs, where, you know, Aaron's staff miraculously blossoms? So again, first question is, why the need for the second demonstration of God's chosen high priest? Second question, L'chaim, that's question number one. Question number two is, as everyone taking a listen, L'chaim, LaCroix. Second question, why the almonds? What's the deal with the almonds? I mean, couldn't the stick have produced any number of fruit or growth? I mean, it could have done anything. It could have produced, peaches. Or it could have produced cherries or whatever. It could have produced any number of items. Why specifically almonds, right? The whole point was to show that Aaron's staff, Aaron is the chosen one, Aaron is the high priest from amongst all the tribes. The tribe of Levi is the chosen one, and from the tribe of Levi, it's Aaron who's the high priest. So it's the one staff from all the 12 that blossoms is Aaron's. Okay? But why specifically almonds? That's the second question. And our first question was, why the need for a second demonstration of Aaron's chosenness? Everything's coming across clear so far? Yes? You understand the questions? Good. Fantastic. I have faith in you. Now, take a look. Take a look as we go back inside. Take a look-see at. Oh, by the way, I'm looking around the screen, and I want to welcome, very special welcome to Lolly. Hey, Lolly. It's good to see you. By the way, hold on. I know what you're thinking. How come I didn't get a shout out? That's what you're all thinking that. The answer is because I see you all the time. And I already told you that I love you guys. So listen, we're already, right? But Lolly, it's been a little while. It's good to see you. Hi, everybody. And hi, Lolly. Good. That's it.
Thank you.
All right. Awesome. Great to see you. Now, let's get back in. So we just asked two questions. Why the need for a second demonstration? Second, proof that Aaron was chosen, and why is the proof not in the pudding, but in the almonds? Why the almond pudding? Why the almond proof? Good. Let's jump in to some answers. First question first. I'm going to share my screen again. Let's get this up and running. Okay, here we go. We are going to look at the Chizkuni. The Chizkuni is a commentary, and he writes the following. Linda, are you available to read?
I am.
Nice. Quick on the draw. I love it. T- Text, listen, you guys, I put you on call tonight. Text number two, take it away.
I had my cursor in place.
Good.
And take from them a staff. This test was necessary inasmuch as they further quarreled regarding the tribe of Levi. The sign of the firepans was only regarding Aaron alone. A further sign was needed to distinguish between the tribe of Levi and the other tribes.
So look how the Chizkuni frames it. The Chizkuni says that why the need for two tests, why the need for two proofs, if you will, two miracles. He says, look, the first miracle with the fire pan competition or contest where everyone else died except for Aaron who brought the incense and God accepted that. That was a demonstration. That was proof that God chose Aaron. But how do we know that Aaron's children, right, that it's going to be passed along, that the kahuna, the priesthood, goes in a hereditary way to the tribe of Levi, to his children? That was where the second sign comes in. That was a staff that was kind of symbolic of the entire tribe, in other words, a broader group. So the first sign or the first proof was Aaron as the individual. So there was an accusation, if you will, against Aaron saying, who put him in charge? And God says, I put him in charge. That was the first demonstration. The second demonstration was, oh, and by the way, I'm also putting his children in charge. His children will be the Kohanim for all time. They will be the priests for all time. So these two proofs, these two tests, these two demonstrations, these two miracles demonstrated that Aaron was chosen and that his children, his progeny, would likewise be chosen, the tribe of Levi. Good. That's what the Chizkuni clarifies. Fantastic. We're still left with our question about almonds. That answered the first question, why the need for two demonstrations. The second question, though, still stands, what's up with the almonds? But don't worry, we have Rashi. Rashi to the rescue. He comes in, a cape with the R on it. Here we go. Rashi comes in and Rashi helps us out. Text number three, explaining why the almonds. Sandrine, live from Michigan. Am I Michiganing you right, correct? Is that correct?
Michigan.
Yeah. Michigan.
Hello.
Love that. Which city in Michigan are you?
New Buffalo.
New Buffalo. Love it.
Yes.
Excellent. Beautiful. By the way, I've been to the old Buffalo. New Buffalo so much better. I'm just saying. They've improved it. That was a joke. Okay. Text number three, why the almonds? Take a look.
Now, why did it bear particularly almonds? That is a fruit that blossoms quicker than other fruit. Likewise, he who opposes the priesthood, his punishment comes quickly.
Wow. Rashi drops like little death and doom destruction bomb on us right there. He drops a little, I don't know what the right word is, a little devastation bomb on the conversation. Look at this. Rashi asked the question that we asked. Why the almonds? Okay, you wanted to prove that Aaron and his tribe and his family, they're the chosen ones. Wonderful. Great. But why almonds? Rashi says, you know why? Because of all fruit, it's the almonds that blossom quicker than other fruits. Now, I need to step in right here before we continue that, the explaining the Rashi. Do almonds really blossom quicker than other fruits? I will tell you this. In Jewish sources, it says that it takes almonds 21 days to blossom. Or from the time it starts to the time they come out. Or maybe when it blossoms, I don't know which part of the development. But either way, it's 3 weeks and it's supposed to be quicker than other things. Google it. Let me know what you find. But that's what it says in Jewish sources. It gives specifically the number of 21 days. So the almonds blossom quick. And what's the message? So what's the point? So Rashi says, if someone opposes the priesthood, Aaron and his family, his punishment, like the almonds, his punishment comes quickly. That's the message from the almonds. Remember, this whole story began because Korach and the folks and the 250 folks were opposing the kahuna, the priesthood, and Aaron's role in the priesthood. So the message here is, no, God says, I chose Aaron, I chose his children, and if you oppose, then it's not going to be good. it's going to be not good real quick, like the almonds blossom quickly. Okay, I don't know how you feel about this, but to me, it's a bit of a negative message. Are you with me on this? It's a bit of a negative lesson here. Likewise, he who opposed the priesthood, his punishment comes quickly. Is there a positive message that we can take from this? After all, Aaron's priesthood and the role of the Levium, of the Levites, is affirmed by the almonds. So is the affirmation just in that don't oppose it or else it's going to come down fast in a not good way? I mean, is that the only connection, or do we have a positive connection? Something about Aaron, about the his children, the priests, the Levites, something about the priesthood that speaks to the theme of almonds, of something developing quickly, and, but in a positive way. Not just those who oppose it, their demise will come quickly, but in a positive way that represents something that is fast or quick or something, but in a positive way. And the answer is yes. There is a positive message. Rashi gives us the negative take, but there's a positive message that is shared by our sages, especially the Hasidic masters. Okay, so far we have the story of Korach, Korach's demise, the demise of the 250 people, the second sign of the staffs. We had two questions: why the second sign, why the almond? We said two points had to be proven, one that Aaron is chosen, one that his descendants will be chosen. And the second point regarding the almonds, death and doom will come quickly to those who oppose the priesthood. And then I asked the question just now, is there a positive lesson? And the answer is yes. Let's unfold that positive message right now. Look at that. It took 30 seconds. Okay, here we go. Here we go. In order to understand this, we're going to get into a Talmudic discussion. The Talmudic discussion is regarding the trumpets. They would have certain trumpets that they would sound. They would blow their trumpets to announce the onset of various special occasions. Like, for example, Shabbat. Before Shabbat, they would sound the trumpet six times to announce the approach of Shabbat. If any of you have been in Crown Heights for Shabbat, anybody been in Crown Heights for Shabbat? I know many of you have visited Crown Heights, but Crown Heights for Shabbat, maybe one day soon we'll have Shabbat in the Heights, right? Maybe one day soon we'll be able to do that. But if you've ever been to Crown Heights, or maybe even some other Jewish communities, before Shabbat, they have a siren that plays like 5-10 minutes before candlelighting. This big, it's like an air raid siren. Imagine like an air raid siren, like go to your bunkers, something's about to hit, like level of sound.
They have it in Jerusalem.
In Yerushalayim as well, good, in Yerushalayim as well.
Yerushalayim for Shabbat, yeah.
Yes, excellent, good. So they have it there as well. This goes back to ancient times, before air raid sirens, right? They used to sound the trumpets, the trumpets. They had silver trumpets, which the Torah talks about the making of, and they were supposed to sound it for the holidays. So they would sound six trumpet sounds before Shabbat to announce the onset of Shabbat, and the same thing is true before the holidays. The Talmud is wondering the following question. The Talmud is wondering, what's the deal? What if Yom Kippur falls out on Saturday night, Sunday? Okay? Let's just say. Now, I don't believe it can, the way our calendar is set now, that Yom Kippur falls out on a Sunday. I don't believe it goes straight Friday into Sunday. I don't think I've ever had that situation. But back in the day, you know, they didn't have a set calendar. It went by the moon sightings, and it was a bit of a different setup. So the question is simple. So if you have Shabbat and you go straight into Yom Kippur, start Saturday night, do you sound the shofar on Shabbat toward the end of Shabbat in anticipation for Yom Kippur, or not? We know typically you're not going to sound the shofar on Shabbat. We typically don't play instruments or sound the shofar on Shabbat. However, maybe it's for a good cause. Maybe it's for a good cause because we want to alert folks that the holiday is upcoming. You're going from Shabbat to Yom Kippur, so maybe you sound the sounds. And in fact, it would be useful for the Kohanim, for the priests, who need to know that, you know, you have a new day, a new service, and it's going to be the holy day of Yom Kippur with a very unique sacrificial service to boot. So maybe you do sound the shofar. The Talmud, we have the excerpt from the original Talmudic text. I'm going to read it only because it's a little bit complicated. I want to throw in some commentary as I do it. It's going to be a little bit convoluted just because we're taking it, pulling it out of context. But hopefully, I'm going to give you enough context and explanation to make it work. Again, we're talking about sounding the trumpets on Shabbat for Yom Kippur. And should the Kohanim, maybe the priest need it, maybe they don't need to hear it. That's what the Talmud is getting into. Sharing my screen in 3, 2, 1. Let's jump in. Okay, here we go. The Talmud says Tractate Shabbat. The Talmud says that you probably do not need to sound the shofar. You know why? Again, try to read into the words. It's out of context. It's going to be a little bulky with the words, but work with me on this. And I said to him, don't worry about that opening. Let's just jump in. You cannot prove this from here. Again, don't worry about that. Because priests are vigilant and can be trusted to know this on their own, and there is no need to sound the shofar. The Talmud says you do not need to sound the shofar. Why? Because the priests are vigilant, because they're on their game. You don't need to remind them that Yom Kippur is coming. They are on it. They got it. Don't worry about the priests. They know what's coming. Now, before Shabbat, it's for everybody. Everybody needs a reminder. But the Kohanim, the priests do not need a reminder. In the language of the Talmud says, Kohanim, Zerizin, Hain. Zerizin. Zerizin, Makdimin, Lemitzvot. Zerizin means they have alacrity. They are on the ball. They are vigilant. They are ready to roll. The priests don't need a shofar reminder. They got it in their calendars. They got it here. They got it here. They're on it. Let's continue. Mar Kashisha, the son of Rav Chista, said to Rav Ashi, do we say that the priests are vigilant in that regard? Aha! This is a gotcha question. Didn't we learn in the Mishnah that 3 blasts were sounded in the temple on Friday to stop the people from work, and 3 more were sounded to demarcate between sacred and profane? Apparently, even the priests required the blast to alert them to the beginning and end of Shabbat. The Talmud says, no, as Abaye said in a different context, that certain matters were undertaken for the rest of the people of Jerusalem. So to hear, these blasts were sounded for the rest of the people in Jerusalem and not for the priests, although the shofar blasts, the trumpet blasts, were sounded from the place of the Temple Mount. It wasn't for the Kohanim. It wasn't to remind the priests of the impending Shabbat. Rather, it was for the people. So on Yom Kippur, getting ready for Yom Kippur, we do not need to sound the shofar. No need to sound the shofar for the interests of the priests, because the priests are vigilant. I'm going to stop share because I want to make sure that that came across in English. Yes? Understand what the Talmud is saying? The Talmud is basically saying you do not need to sound the shofar blast for the Kohanim, for the priests. Not for Shabbat, not for Yom Kippur, never. You know why? Because you don't need to remind the priests that they have a shift, or that there are sacrifices, or that it's not a weekday anymore, it's a Shabbat, or it's not Shabbat, it's a Yom Kippur sacrifice. You don't need to remind them. They know it. They've got it. They're on top of their game. Let me share with you another text in another context, similar idea. This is with regards to the gifts to the Kohen, Truma, etc., special gifts that the Kohen was given. Let's take a look at Rashi Rosita. Please unmute and please read text number 5.
Priests are Zerizim, This race is stated in many places. We assume that if they are inducted into service, they must be proficient in the laws governing the temple.
Perfect, perfect. Exactly. Bidiyuk. What does it mean? Kohanim Zerizin, as Rashi says in different tractate of the Talmud in Erevin, Rashi says clearly, Beferish, Rashi says that means if they're priests and they're serving, they know what they're doing. You don't need to worry. A Kohen is on his game. A Kohen knows what he's doing, is not going to forget, doesn't need reminders. A Kohen's got it. Kohen is a professional. A Kohen knows what he's doing. Very, very well trained and well skilled and on his game. But as you see, if you see peeking at the bottom of your screen, maybe you're someone that likes to look ahead. I admire that in you. I admire that in you. But if you look ahead, you know what you'll find? You'll find that it says nature or nurture. And in fact, that is my next question. Not to be or not to be. That's so not the next question. The next question is nature or nurture. We just said that when it comes to a Kohen, you do not need to be concerned. You do not need to send the Kohen a reminder, a text message, a shofar meme. You do not need to send the Kohen a reminder about what the Kohen needs to do. The Kohen's like, I got this. No need to worry. Zerizin Hain, they got this. They're moving. They're on it. They're on the ball. They're on their game. That's it. Now here's the question. How'd they get like that? How did Kohanim get like that? And I'm going to give you three options. Not two options. Nature, nurture, amateur hour. Two options, amateur hour. We have three tonight, my friends. Three tonight, three options. Is it nature? In other words, is it that biology, baby, the Kohen DNA, right? 23andMe. You do the genetic testing, you got the Kohen gene, that's going to indicate that you're on things. You're the type of person that's got your responsibilities, you got it, you don't need reminders, you're on it, you get it done quickly, alacrity, zerizin hain. Is it nature? Is it biology? Option number one. Option number two, it's not biology, but rather it is learned behavior. It comes with training, with education, it comes with training others, it comes with becoming so ingrained with the service of the priesthood, right? That so much training, so much learning, so much teaching, that it becomes integrated and zerizin hain, and they're on it because there's so much education. So is it a genetic trait that they got their stuff? Is it a learned quality or skill or reality? Is it learned? Or number three, I told you we have an extra one. Not just nature and nurture. One more. Third. Or number three, is it due to the sacredness of the task, due to the importance, the mammoth importance of their task, it elevated them up to that level of zerizin. Does that make sense, what I just said? I'm not getting a strong reaction. And that's fine. So I'll say it one more time quickly. Is it number one, nature? Genetically, they're wired to be on top of their game. Quick, alacrity, they got it done. Is it number two, second option? Is it a learned behavior through education, training, and them teaching, becoming mentors for other Kohanim, for younger Kohanim? Because of all that, because of all the repetition, all the training, it becomes ingrained in them, and therefore it becomes second nature, and they're on it. Or number three, it's not nature, it's not even training. It's how serious a task they have, how important an obligation they've been given, that they naturally rise to the occasion. When you give someone a very important job, that itself brings out the power in them, and they don't forget, and they don't drop the ball, and they're on it right away. So is it inherent, is it learned, or is it from the outside due to the sanctity and sacredness of the task at hand? The truth is, we have indications for all three. We're going to go back in reverse order. 3, 2, 1. In other words, I'm giving you the outline now of what we're about to do. In other words, when we look through the sources, we will find that in some places it says, you know why the Kohanim are Zrizin? You know why they're all in, why they're so on their game? They don't need any reminders. They don't need any encouragement. They do it. They get it done. They get it done early. You know why? Some places say because they have a very holy task, special task. Some places it says because of their education and their mentoring. And other places it says, you know why? Because of their spiritual DNA. All three are indicated in the sources. Let's go through them. You might be wondering, why is this relevant? If you're wondering that, then you need to know how we roll here, right? Everything gets tied up at the end. So if you think there are loose ends, we don't do loose ends. That's not how we roll here, Wednesday night's Torah studies. We don't have like little extra plot devices that just never, you know, just stay out there. You know, that's not how we roll. Everything's going to get tied together. So if you're wondering how this all connects, just hang on. Just give it some time. You'll see it. Again, why were the Kohanim Zrizin? How did they get like that? Is it nature? Is it learned? Or is it the sanctity or sacredness of the task? The answer is yes. Let's go through all three. And for this, I will share my screen one more time. Let's get back into the text. Here we go. Wow. Okay. First thing we need to know is text number 6. I don't know that I'm going to read it inside or that we'll read it inside. I think I'm going to paraphrase it. I mean, you can look at it. It's there for you to look at. But let me explain what's going on. Different sacrifices had different rules. So if you brought a sacrifice, let's say during the day, okay, because you could only bring sacrifices during the day. If you brought it during the day, so some were completely burned in the altar. Some were eaten by the Kohanim. Some were eaten by the person who brought the sacrifice. So every sacrifice was different. But let's talk about one of the sacrifices that would be eaten by either the priest or by the person who brought it. So how long did you have to eat the meat from that animal? Depends on the sacrifice. Some you could eat that day and the next night. Some you could eat for a few days. Whatever it was, there was always a time limit. You couldn't like leave it leftovers in your fridge, you know, or freeze it for like, you know, oh, hey, look, we have some food for like, you know, next Shabbat. That wouldn't work. You have a very limited amount of time to eat the meat from your sacrifice. Okay. So let's read it inside. Maimonides says, text number 6. Let's do Lali. Are you up to reading? Can you read the screen? You have it available?
Hi. Yeah.
All right. Awesome.
According to scriptural law, all of these sacrifices that may be eaten on the day of their sacrifice and the following night may be eaten until dawn. To separate a person from sin, our sages said that they may only be eaten until midnight.
Perfect. So when it comes to a sacrifice, let's give the example. Let's say the law says that this particular sacrifice, you can only eat it that day and that night, the night that follows. So really, you could eat it all night until the next dawn, because a day and then the next night until dawn. But the sages said, no. Finish it by midnight. So eat it today, eat it tonight, right, the next night, but try to finish it by midnight. But really, you could eat it longer, but they gave you the midnight thing so that you wouldn't go into after dawn. They pushed it back, created a bit of a fence around that law. That's a device to make sure that you weren't going to go over that number. Now, the reality is that is for everybody, including the priests. Again, take a look. Take a look at what we said, what Lali read in text 6. You can really eat it all night until dawn, but in order to make sure that everyone's going to do it right and correctly, they moved it back up till midnight. Okay, because we don't trust people, so we basically gave them an earlier deadline because we don't trust people. You know, people are always pushing the envelope on time. Like, oh, I have another minute. If you tell people till dawn, they're going to end up eating it for breakfast after it gets light. So you push it back to midnight. So even if somebody's a little bit, you know, not so careful with time, they're still going to be hopefully within that window of the night. So that's a device to get everybody on board and to make sure that they're doing it right. But the truth is, even the priests were told to eat it by midnight. And the question that all the commentaries ask is why the priests? Didn't we say that the priests are the reason that they're on their game? You can tell them till dawn. Why do you have to move it back until midnight? So I'm going to read this. We have a beautiful answer from Rabbi Menachem Azaria Defano. He writes like this, two answers. Number one, by the way, this is the Ramah, the famous Ramah, the famous, or the Ramah, one of the famous commentaries writes the following. We only say that the priests are diligent, that there's reason regarding temple service. When it comes to the service, that's when they're diligent. This was not a service. This was eating food. This is eating meat. The concern is that even for the priests, that if you give them the whole night till dawn, they might be a little bit loose with time and they might go after dawn. So therefore, even the priests that are usually diligent, you still tell them midnight, because this is not part of the temple service. This is eating meat from a sacrifice, but it's not part of the service itself. Another answer, and I'm going to summarize this answer. It's a bit of a long answer, and it's a bit complicated the way it's written. The answer is, no, we really do trust the priests, but we don't want to make a distinction between the priests and everyone else, because that's going to be complicated. Imagine if we had two sets of rules. Everyone else has to eat their sacrifices by midnight. The priests could do it until dawn. At that point, everything's confused, and you're going to lose the whole point that you're trying to do, which is move people back, because they'll say, if the priest can do it, then we can do it, and then the whole thing's going to get ruined. So therefore, we tell the priest, you know what, take one for the team. Also, we're going to tell you midnight. Also, do it by then, even though we trust you, but we don't trust others. Therefore, but toe the line, do the keep it the same, keep it synced with everybody. Therefore, do it by midnight. So we have two different answers. One basically says that the priests are not diligent in this respect. And one says, no, they are diligent. It's just that within this specific case, we want to equal the playing field, so we move everybody back to midnight. What's the difference between answer number one and answer number two? Answer number one says, we do not say the priests are diligent in this case. That's only with regards to temple service. When it comes to eating from the carbon, eating from the sacrifice, which is not a service in the temple, it's, you know, you're eating it at home or whatever, it's later on you're eating it. So therefore, we are concerned that the priests also will not be on top of their game, and therefore we have to move them back to midnight. That tells us that it's not genetic. Are you with me? I hope you're following me with this logic. That tells us that it's not genetic, that they're not inherently zeris, and they're not inherently diligent. It's only that in this case, by temple service, not this case, it's only in the case of temple service, because of how important the service is, that they are zeris, that they're very careful because of the magnitude of what they're doing. That's like the third rationale that we gave before. The second answer says, no, they are diligent. They are diligent by all cases, and that would go either like the first or second rationale. Either it's genetic or it's learned through their training, but either way, they've become diligent people in all regards. So again, just to clarify, we have three different ways of understanding, three options of understanding why they're diligent or how they became diligent. Either inherently, genetically, or number two, it's learned, or number three, because of what they're being called on to do, that evokes that within them. So we have one answer here that speaks to it being evoked by the temple service. We have another answer that says, no, they have it inherently within them. The reason why in this case that they're bumped back to midnight is for technicality, so as not to confuse everyone else. Now, what is the rationale for the learned behavior? If we want to say that their diligence is not inherent but is learned, where does it come from? So here we go. Again, I'm going to read the text now, because we have to get to the punchline, and we're almost near our time. Take a look at Deuteronomy. It talks that this is the blessing to the tribe of Levi, to the Kohanim. It says that they should be the teachers. They shall teach your ordinances to Jacob and your Torah to Israel. They shall place incense before you and burnt offerings upon your altar. That is a reference. The incense and the burnt offerings, we know who did that, the Kohanim. The Kohanim were also the ones, therefore, who shall teach your ordinances to Jacob. They were the teachers. And as teachers, Maimani says this, Rashi says this, their teachers, the priests are diligent, says Rashi, for they are God-fearing Torah masters. What evokes their diligence? Why are these reason? Because they are students and teachers of Torah. They are Torah masters. That brings out the diligence or the zrizin. They're on top of their game because of their proficiency in Torah. That is, again, not nature, but that is a learned quality. And finally, we have the final idea, which is, again, this comes from here, from the Rebbe's teachings and other teachings, other mystical teachings that talk about the inherent nature of Aaron's, of the Kohen's zerizus, of their alacrity. Take a look at how the Rebbe frames it, and now we come back to the lesson from the almonds. One of the lessons, I'm reading inside, one of the lessons to be learned from the Torah portion of Korach. The Torah tells us that the symbol of Aaron's priesthood centered on the almonds. One of the explanations given as to why God chose the symbol of almonds is because they ripen from the moment they blossom until they become fruit in a brief period. The fruit are very quickly ready to eat. This underscores two ideas. The Alter Rebbe explains that priests are blessed in this regard. When they bless Israel, the blessings not only come to pass, but moreover, they are drawn down here below rapidly without any delays. And the second point, the Talmud states that priests are diligent, that the work of the priests was performed in a manner of almonds. Not only did they do the work, but they did it with alacrity. And now it all comes together. What does it mean? What's going on here? Let me explain. We asked the question before, why is it that the sign to affirm Aaron's priesthood and his children's priesthood, why that sign was associated with almonds? And we had Rashi. Rashi said to show that if you challenge, it's going to be a quick end, quick punishment. And now we have a positive understanding. No, the almonds are not teaching us about the guy who's trying to start trouble, that they're going to get a comeuppance quickly. No, or I can't say no, Rashi says it, but in addition to that, there's a positive message that the almonds speak to the nature of the Kohen. Who was the Kohen? Someone who worked with alacrity. And why did they work with alacrity? Because they were blessed. As Kohanim, they were blessed. Number one, they were blessed with an important task. Number two, they were blessed with Torah training and knowledge and teaching. And number three, they were blessed inside their DNA to be people that had and carried alacrity. They got the job done, and they got it done quickly. It's getting it right and getting it done right now as well. So let's talk about takeaways. So now we have, again, just so you know, no loose ends. We've answered the nature and nurture. We've demonstrated all three in various sources about their alacrity. And we've answered the original question, why the almonds? Why the almonds? To demonstrate this quality of the Kohanim, the priesthood, which is doing things, getting it done right and getting it done quickly, done efficiently and effectively, in a beautiful way. That is the nature of the Kohanim. So what's the takeaway for us? I want to share with you three takeaways, and this is connected with the Rebbe's Yahrzeit tonight and how the Rebbe looked at people. I would say one of the greatest qualities of the Rebbe's leadership is the fact, is how the Rebbe looked at others. I'll tell you this. Most people don't trust others. You might disagree with me, but then I'll disagree with you. Most people don't actually trust other people. They don't. Most people do not trust other people. I don't mean that you think someone's going to rip you off. I don't mean that. But I mean, like, if you really want something done, you know the phrase, do it yourself? Yeah, you know that one? Most people really believe that no one can do that thing as well as they can. Most people believe that there are things that they can do better than others, and they don't trust others exactly with those things. That's the fact. The Rebbe had an incredible faith and trust and belief in others. The Rebbe really, really genuinely believed in others. The Rebbe really believed in others' potentials, in the potential of others. And therefore, the Rebbe taught us that it's within the power of everybody to step up to the plate and do what they need to do and do amazing things and live the life that they can live and bring Mashiach and fulfill the purpose of the universe, of creation. And the Rebbe really believed in you and I. The Rebbe really believed that we could get it done, that we have what it takes. The Rebbe didn't handhold. The Rebbe didn't coddle. The Rebbe didn't say, I'm going to do it for you. The Rebbe said, you can do it. I want you to do it. I need you to do it. The Rebbe created one of the greatest armies in world history of leaders. I don't know of anybody who's created more leaders that have had a greater impact than the Rebbe and his 5,000 plus 6,000 shluchim and Chabad houses around the world, who each hopefully empower in turn others to empower others to empower others. The Rebbe created a machine, and I don't mean that in any trivial sense. The Rebbe created an army of individuals who he trusted to lead and who he trusted to empower others in turn to lead as well. Because the Rebbe really believed in people. And so what's the takeaway here? The takeaway is on all three levels, you and I are empowered to act in a way that's effective and act in a way that's good and act in a way that is with alacrity. Number one, due to the enormous task at hand, we have an incredible calling to make the world a better place. And that, the Rebbe believed, would encourage people to step up to the plate and get it done. Number two, teach Torah. The more Torah that we teach, the more Torah that we study. It encourages us, again, to act and act decisively and act in a quick fashion to make the world a better place. And finally, the Rebbe believed that within you and I, within every single human being on this planet, there is a core of goodness, a core of beauty, a core of connection. And that connection is just waiting to be unleashed. The Rebbe believed in all of us to tap into our potential and to be the best person that we could be. When the Rebbe looked at a person, the Rebbe saw them for their potential, and the greatest gift was that a person could see themselves through the same lens that the Rebbe saw them. That would be the greatest gift, that we should see ourselves the way the Rebbe saw us, that we should see within ourselves that same potential. And so, my friends, in the final analysis, we're all meant to be almonds. Well, not exactly almonds, but we're all meant to be the priests. Just like the priests are the ones who get the job done, and not only get the job done, but get the job done in a way that's effective, in a way that's conscientious, in a way that's with alacrity. You and I were entrusted and empowered by God Almighty to be in this world, given a task, and asked to go ahead and make this world a better place. The task brings out our ability, our education brings out our ability, and of course, our ability gives us the ability that we need to get the job done. So, on this day of Gimel Tammuz, the third day of Tammuz, the 26th Yahrzeit of the Rebbe, let's all pledge, let's all commit for ourselves and for all of us and for the world to each do what we can now, not tomorrow, not next week, not next year, not next decade, but now, with alacrity, with zrizus, with alacrity, with quickness, with speed, to turn over the world in a positive way, to transform the world by transforming ourselves. Split the atom, and you unleash atomic energy. And when I say atom, I don't mean A-T-O-M, I mean A-D-A-M, Adam, a mensch, right? Transform a mensch, transform the world. So let's take the encouragement from tonight's class. Let's be Aaron. Let's be the priests. For this, we can emulate them. We each have this ability to be like the almond, to get the world to be beautiful, to sprout beautiful things. Let's take the dried sticks, the things that look dead, the things that others would cast away, and let's bring them back to life like Aaron's staff. The dead staff that blossomed and bore fruit. Let's bring beauty back into this world. Let's bring holiness into this world. And let's do so with joy and enthusiasm and with zrizus, with alacrity. And let us say, Amen. Thank you for joining me tonight for Torah studies. Thank you for studying with me tonight. And I look forward to continuing our studies. We have our daily power parasha tomorrow at 12. We have 8 p.m. tomorrow. We have Tanya. And of course, on this special day, it's appropriate to make a specific commitment to increase in Torah study, mitzvah performance, tzedakah, whatever your mitzvah you want it to be, take a mitzvah for in honor of this special day, the third of Tammuz, and go for it. All right. That's my charge. That's my encouragement. All right. Good to see you all. Laila Tov. A gute Nacht. We'll see you all soon.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Pleasure. Great to see you all. Bye. Take care.
Thank you.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.